On the demolition things, security fences need to be provided around property when they're in a vulnerable state. There was one in my neighborhood on my block, which was set empty, or the lot with a hole in the ground for several weeks until the developer moved to the next stage of construction. There needs to be post-demolition inspection to make sure that all codes and, if appropriate, land restoration has occurred.
Mayor, can I just pose a question to Paul for later when you come back? Paul, in my neighborhood, there's a big multifamily development going up which has a fence around it, and at night there's a security guard. I believe that was something that we did the fire, that was a life safety issue, so now there's a security person there at night. Yet when some of these demolitions are going on, there's nothing around the perimeter of the house that's being demolished or being rebuilt. And I'm just curious about what the thinking is in terms of the two standards. One, we have a very tight standard in terms of perimeter and security. The other is much looser. There might be a logic to it, but I'd at some point like to know more about that.
Porter, thank you. Welcome.
Hello, I'm Margaret Davis with United Neighborhoods for Reform, and I'm delighted to be here. Creativity and quality. These are attributes Portland has embraced in the past, and we'd like to see more of them in the home construction occurring now in our city. At United Neighborhoods for Reform, the first choice for Portland housing should be protecting the affordable green home that's already there. With additions, accessory dwelling units, and renovations, much can be done to modernize and alter a house for future generations. These activities provide the added bonus of employing more local people than new construction does. If a house has to go, deconstruction should be mandatory. And then there is the matter of new construction. What goes up on the residential land that is arguably Portland's finest resource? This new development should create an improvement for everyone. To do this, it will contribute open space as its neighboring properties do, respecting the size of contextual setbacks, footprint, mass, and height of existing nearby homes, determining the specific allowances for these items and the context to be considered will be the work of the task force as proposed in UNR's resolution. By the way, city code already regulates setbacks, footprint, and height, but no one thought to build to the maximums until now, which is a direct result of considering a neighborhood more of a profit center than simply a place to live. In better regulating setbacks, footprint, mass, and height of new construction, compatibility with established housing is better assured, as is access to solar power for energy and vegetable gardens, along with space for mature trees. This is how Portland can spark more creativity and quality. Building smaller is more environmental. A larger share of the construction budget can go toward more durable materials, and home layouts can make smarter use of space. Many Portland residents would say creativity and quality are why we chose to live here. Finally, we request that the task force take a look at current zoning and lot splitting policies to protect existing housing. Some 28,000 homes citywide sit on plots slated for greater density. Let's appreciate the breathing room and the opportunities for creativity and quality that they provide. With new guidelines sensitive to established neighborhood standards, we believe it will once again be possible to be both pro-development and pro-Portland. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Next three are Terry Parker, Sharon Genesi, and Judy Parsons. And they'll be followed by John Sandy, Al Ellis, and Claire Coleman Evans.
Terry, I think you're on first.
Thank you, Mayor Hales. My name is Terry Parker. I am also on the UNR Steering Committee, and yes, this testimony has been vetted by UNR. Today, it is my responsibility to present and clarify UNR's position on the equitable makeup and establishment of a redevelopment standards task force slash work group that is recommended to be comprised of 50% neighborhood organization representatives and 50% city staff and other concerned citizens as per UNR resolution. Neighborhood representatives are the people who are active with and actually live in the neighborhoods, where the next house to be demolished might be the one next door, down the block, or around the corner. These are the people who have a view of the street from their front windows that could become impaired by a replacement house that is not set back from the sidewalk, or could have a towering, out-of-scale house constructed on the property next to theirs that would cast a shadow and block the sunlight. To avoid a conflict of interest, perceived or real, we ask that neighborhood representatives are not professionally connected with or earn their living in the or earn their living in the land use, planning, development, architecture, or real estate fields. We welcome people from these fields to be on the task force, just not filling the neighborhood representative seats at the table. Likewise, in the interest of adding more diversity, voices, and opportunities for qualified neighborhood people who haven't participated in but aspire to be part of the official city process, we ask that the preference be given to neighborhood representatives who have not recently served or are currently serving on another BDS, BES, BPS, PBOT, Task Force, Advisory Committee, Work Group, or Comp Plan Policy Expert Group. Again, this avoids a possible conflict of interest. We also ask that UNR has representatives at the table. Meetings need to be scheduled at times when working people can attend and located in various neighborhoods. Finally, as opposed to appointing a chairperson, we suggest the first order official business for the task force should be to elect a chairperson and vice chairperson. In closing, UNR wants to see an equitable and well-publicized application process followed by a task force with an open and transparent process that has a meaningful deadline for results. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Ganassi, good afternoon.
Hi. My name is Sharon Ganassi. I'm chair of the NWDA Air Quality Committee, and I'm testifying today on behalf of UNR, the United Neighborhoods for Reform, about the jurisdiction of asbestos and lead regulations and demolitions. Based on our research, we believe Portland has jurisdictional authority to create ASMAP policies for house demolition sites, including inspecting and monitoring for asbestos and lead. A survey by the National Association of Clean Air Agencies, NCAA, wrote in December 4, 2014, the Clean Air Act explicitly allows state and local air pollution control agencies to adopt programs more stringent than those of the federal government. Specifically, Section 1216 states that air quality agencies are not precluded from adopting or enforcing any standards, limitations, or requirements as long as they are at least as stringent as those required under the federal program. Over the past 3 years, the city has issued 752 demolition permits. The actual number of demolitions is much higher. Unregulated demolitions occur throughout Portland neighborhoods, and neighbors living near the demolitions are increasingly alarmed at asbestos and lead emissions. The question is, who is looking after public health from unregulated demolitions in Portland? Oregon's Lane County, other Oregon cities, and Southwest Clean Air Agency in Washington have adopted rules for asbestos-containing materials and lead-based paint in demolitions. I have here a list of Lane County regulations and asbestos demolition guidance from Southwest Clean Air Agency in Washington. I pass them out to you. If Lane County, the Southwest Clean Air Agency, and other cities can produce rules governing toxic demolition materials, then we in Portland can do the same. We're asking the city to accept responsibility for creating regulations and enforcement for asbestos and lead emissions and demolitions. Developers currently profiting from the demolitions should pay a fee for accredited inspectors to ensure that all regulations are followed. Public health costs should be a consideration in setting the fees. I attended a memorial in London 2 years ago for a dear friend of mine, a fine architect known for his work on the Ashmolean Museum at Oxford. He died of mesothelioma from exposure to asbestos. He was exposed during the interior demolition of a house he was remodeling for himself about 35 years ago. He was at the top of his career, took excellent care of himself, and was well-loved by friends. If demolitions are properly monitored and the air toxics abated, all of us, developers, workers, and neighbors, will benefit. Thank you.
Thanks, Sharon. Thank you very much. Yeah. Welcome.
Hi. Good afternoon. My name is Judy Parsons, and I'm a member of the UNR Steering Committee. And Mayor, during the December 17th hearing, you asked about which levers would be affected in the demolition process. Due to the serious public health, safety, and environment concerns at these demolition sites in our neighborhoods, we propose one answer is creating the hazmat lever to protect Portland residents. One of our policy proposals is for the city to require hazmat surveys and abatement plans that are prepared by certified abatement contractors to be submitted with the city's residential demolition application. Based on our research, we are shocked and alarmed that Portland does not already require these documents. We have confirmed that in many other Oregon cities, such as Medford, Tualatin, and Lake Oswego, those cities do require such documentation. For instance, in Lake Oswego, we heard earlier where it was explained as a checkbox on the application. In the material that's passed out to you, you will see that it states, Lake Oswego requires submitting a certificate of compliance for asbestos and lead-based paint removal at their demolition sites in that city. Why is this not being required in Portland? As you see on the Portland's demolition application, which is included in that packet too, the newly added DRAC-approved statement of fact block, which was recently inserted, that Commissioner Fritz referred to as a change in the document to address our concerns, you see the language highlighted there. But due to existing gaps in state hazmat regulations relating to residential demolitions, we think this is a meaningless statement block. Therefore, since BDS, and we just heard Commissioner Fritz earlier, you said BDS does not have the resources, we ask City Council to designate the appropriate department that does have the authority to create hazmat control policies and regulations and to implement, for instance, a specific proposal. We believe Portland does have the authority to do this, and you and our members want to be stakeholders in the process. We believe this is a reasonable request since we find this being done in other Oregon cities and across the country. And I'll point out, this is an item that's on our UNR resolution that 41 neighborhoods have approved in principle, which indicates it's a concern of many citizens throughout the city. We ask that hazmat control policies are put into place as soon as possible in Portland for these demolition sites that are in our neighborhoods. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all.
Judy, just one thing. I'm looking at this. You gave us this packet, right?
Yep.
So, for example, in Lane County, which covers Eugene, there's both a Lane, apparently there's a county air protection agency in addition to the state of Oregon that regulates.
Yes.
So there's a county.
It's the Lane Regional Air Authority, which is the sort of the counterpart to the DEQ here in the state. But it's a local state regulatory account. And you were asking that question, and I really appreciated that, Commissioner Fish. You asked the question.
I don't know.
About whether or not you said, is the state law sufficient to take care of this problem? And the simple answer to that is no. The DEQ is contracted by the EPA to uphold the Clean Air Act, which is federal law. But in this state, our DEQ isn't doing that job properly.
Can I just
so
ask
that's
you a question?
Why we're here.
This is the Lane Regional Air Protection Agency. Is there a equivalent here in Metro or the county?
No, it's a sort of a unique arrangement down there.
Created their own regulatory framework.
And I have to say, I talked to the director this morning, and they're not really very much on top of doing enforcement. They've got the regulations there, but they're not really. That's why it's so important for us not to do two things. You have to do the regulations, but also the enforcement. And we need the fees to pay for that from the developers.
Is the Lane County system also complaint-based?
Well, I think so, but we're really, the DEQ is complaint-based. They call it complaint-based, but what happens, because we have a complaint line on www.portlandair.org, I recently had the experience of a complaint being registered for a business in Northwest Portland that's not permitted, but putting out a lot of emissions, and the complaint person at DEQ called me, and he said, well, I have gone to talk to the manager of that company, and he says that the emissions are only steam. Well, I mean, this is just laughable to us. I mean, 15 years ago, we were saying, what is in the steam is what we want to know. Let's monitor it. But they can't do that.
I don't want to take up everyone else's time, but I also will note that in Lane County, the survey report that the developer is required to fill out, and the survey report could say there is no asbestos, has to be remain on site during the demolition. So there has to be a survey, and it has to remain on site for public inspection. So
right.
I don't
yeah. know. And it has to be enforced.
Thank you.
May I add to that comment? It is also an OSHA requirement that an asbestos survey is generated for workplace. So there should be an asbestos survey. Therefore, if we heard developers earlier testify that they are responsible and they are mitigating based on surveys, great. Require submission of those documents with the application in the city like other cities do. Please.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
The next three are John Sandy, Al Ellis, and Claire Coleman Evans. And they'll be followed by Steve Elder. I believe Rod Merrick had to leave, and Laquita Lanford and Jerry Federico.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is John Sandy, and I'm a Beaumont Wilshire resident. Members of City Council, I'm here to reemphasize and expand on my December 17th testimony regarding the urgent and immediate need to implement best practices and reasonable, responsible house demolition protocols. When someone's exposed to asbestos or lead contaminated dust, they can't be taken outside to fresh air to recover. They can't be taken down to the emergency room, given a shot of adrenaline to mitigate the problems. They are potentially sentenced to serious, irreversible health problems whose symptoms may not appear for years. In my earlier testimony, I highlighted demolition protocol steps that have been proven to lower the risk of public exposure to dangerous toxins in the dust generated during house demolitions, such steps as proper wetting of the structure and debris pile, covering the trucks during transit, daily cleanup of the streets and walkways, and performing partial deconstruction of building materials that show the presence of lead. Our research also identified other easy, proactive steps that have been used to further reduce the risk to general public. Simply providing tacky mats to the neighbors next door to keep the outside dust from being tracked in. Performing thorough cleaning of nearby residences using the special HEPA filter vacuums. Let me remind you, there are scientific studies that demonstrate that lead dust can travel up to 300 feet from a demolition site. And computer models developed by Wayne State University in Detroit that puts the potential impact at even greater distances. Think of how many patios, play areas, and vegetable gardens may be within reach of this potentially dangerous plume. Both the EPA and the CDC have stated there is no safe level of exposure to either lead or asbestos. Younger children are especially susceptible to a life of developmental problems, nervous system, kidney damage, learning disabilities, decreased muscle and bone growth. For the City of Portland not to require and enforce these simple steps that have proven so effective in other communities is, in my mind, morally indefensible. So to restate my request to Council, the City of Portland should immediately require and verify use of these proven protocols for effective and responsible single-family housing demolitions. And I have one other thing that Commissioner Nick Fish segued into. Since you have been up close and personal with the demolition, I acquired a free kit from the Portland Housing Bureau for lead dust. And I'm going to give it to you. Maybe you can sleep a little sounder.
Yeah, Carl will take it for you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Actually, my concern is that my son sleeps a little sounder, but thank you. Yeah, I appreciate it.
Hi, my name's Al Ellis, United Neighborhoods for Reform. While UNR is in total agreement with Mayor Hales in his emphasis on front-end reform and addressing the issue of construction of big homes that don't fit the existing fabric of the neighborhood and the tearing down of viable homes that are affordable, et cetera, we're still, of course, engaged in the demolition area. And I should say that we commend the Bureau of Development Services and the DRAC Demolition Subcommittee for extending the opportunity for us to come in and work out a consensus, a compromise. And I think that's the best way to conduct business in the city. The current, in terms of hazmat policy, most of what I was going to say has been said, but I'll just say that the current policy just seems toothless for requiring an initial of the application applicants acknowledging regulations, and that's it. And you can't expect neighbors to enforce the demolition, the hazardous materials regulations. The missing ingredients here are, as you've heard, are a mandatory inspection prior to the onset of residential demolitions for the purpose of verifying proper abatement and disposal of hazmat materials, and, of course, the funding to implement it. And as you've heard, there are lots of different cities around Oregon that provide good examples of how this is being done in one form or another, and we can learn from these models, and we've submitted some information for you, as Commissioner Fish has referred to. The last thing is that, there are inspections for all kinds of different things when you're purchasing a house: plumbing, electrical, furnace, roofing, dry rot, you name it. And fees are required up front, but there's dividends down the road. And the same thing applies for hazmat inspection, but the dividends down the road are not just for the homeowners and their families. It's for the whole neighborhood, the whole environment. And so it also, while faulty plumbing and electrical wiring may result in flooding or fire, asbestos and lead released in the environment is with us for the long run. And as John has pointed out, it's most severely affects the most vulnerable among us, the children, the sick, the elderly, et cetera. So we think that this hazmat issue really needs to be addressed. And I'm glad that you brought that up right from the get-go. UNR is providing the council with documentation, as I said, and we hope to work collaboratively with you in the formulation and implementation of a viable policy for Portland, in the same way we were able to work with BDS and the DRAC subcommittee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Claire Coleman-Evans, and I'm a member of the UNR Steering Committee. On December 15th, the United Neighbors for Reform sent a letter to the members of City Council requesting action about hazardous materials at residential demolition sites. We restate our request for the city to dedicate the city personnel to monitor the actual demolition activities and to serve as liaisons with state agencies to report any hazmat release problems directly to partnering agencies responsible for enforcement and citing violations, and provide a user-friendly public online access for this purpose. The health and safety of the neighborhoods and the health of the environment are woefully neglected around residential demolitions. We have observed dust clouds that blow around the neighborhood. Demolition debris is often hauled away in trucks with uncovered beds. No complaint numbers are posted on the demolition sites. DEQ has no dedicated asbestos investigators in the local regional asbestos office. The city does not currently require personnel to inspect nor monitor the actual bulldozing of the activities at the residential demolition sites. Since residential demolitions have increased throughout the city, so too have the residents' anxieties and complaints and the release of hazardous materials. We have heard such complaints expressed while we've been attending many neighborhood association meetings. These complaints express concern for public health and safety and the environment. The current complaint-driven system in Portland is not reasonable nor effective, and we ask the city to create a more proactive approach. Who does a resident call when they have these concerns? For 2 years, there has not been a dedicated local inspector in the DEQ Northwest Regional Asbestos Office. BDS suggests calling OSHA, when by the time they show up, the demolition is ended. Plus, OSHA is primarily charged with working with workers' protection and safety, not around the surrounding neighbors, houses, yards, or children. By the time any response may occur, the demolition process is complete and little evidence of dangerous practices remain. Commissioner Fritz, in an Oregonian news report dated December 11, 2013, you were quoted as saying, "It isn't the neighborhood's job to monitor developers' compliance with environmental regulations. Should there be an expectation that neighbors in all parts of the city should be vigilant to make sure the development goes smoothly? Shocking, the reality is that neighbors do have to be the watchdog since the city is not. We believe the city has the authority to correct the existing problem. Since BDO states they lack the authority and resources to further address these incurrences, we request and ask that the mayor and the city council designate an appropriate department responsible for protecting public health, safety, and the environment to create policies and regulations to protect Portland residents from lead, asbestos, and other contaminants during the demolition and the development process. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you all.
The next three are Steve and Elder, Laquita Lanford, and Jerry Federico. Unless Rod Merrick is here.
Rod is here.
After them will be Gary Clifford, Kevin, I believe it's Peterson on 56.
Come on up, Rod. I think somebody has left that she called. So.
Oh, let's go. Okay, Steve Elder, Laquita, Jerry Federico. How about Gary Clifford? Come up.
Yes, he's here. Okay. Welcome. Please.
To the City Council, I'm Steve Elder. I'm with United Neighborhoods for Reform, and I'm here to address the issue of shouldn't a person be able to do what he wants with his property? The obvious answer is yes, but there's more to it. Market forces mandate willingness by buyer and seller. Seeking the best deal is not just a right. It is an economic imperative. But don't those who suffer collateral damage, the 99% whose property is adversely impacted by demolition and replacement, have rights too? We submit that they do. People shopping for houses or for homes want to be in nice neighborhoods with nice houses, nice trees, and nice people. Some want and can afford to live in big new houses. Many others are shut out. It took over 100 years to weave the fabric of our attractive neighborhoods. We don't want it torn apart and shredded. Developers seize opportunities. Their offer might be a little low, but they offer quick closings and don't require repairs. Hassle-free exit for the seller. Developers clear lots as quickly and cheaply as possible and erect the largest, most easily sellable structure for the highest price they can get. Little thought is given to the neighbors in whose backyard the destruction and replacement is perpetrated. When the housing bubble breaks, the demolished livable houses will still be gone, and their looming light-blocking, privacy-invading replacements will remain. As creators of community value, we assert our right to avoid the denigration of our neighborhoods. We seek to impose high cost for removal of sound structures and to provide guidelines for the size and location of their replacements. We claim it is our right and our duty to ourselves and future generations to do all we can to amend to maintain the community, the integrity of our community.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Mayor.
Very poetic. Mayor Hales, City Council, my name is Rod Merrick, architect and Neighborhood Association Land Use Chair. And first of all, I'd like to thank Commissioner Fritz and especially Mayor Hales for engaging the issue of residential demolitions affecting affecting citizens across the city. I also want to thank the many neighborhood and preservation groups that have pressed for a solution, especially United Neighbors for Reform. But this measure that's before you, while it is a half step forward, is two steps back. The issues associated with demolition regulation are many, from preservation of viable, affordable housing, protection of public health from demolition process, preservation of cultural and historic resources that are important to the character of our city, and not least, the common courtesy of informing neighbors of an impending demolition. These all need to be addressed, if not now, in the very near future. Yesterday, I found online the DRAC 2455-200 rewrite on the agenda for today, presuming that is the version under consideration. Previously, I worked to understand the issues and made a deep dive into editing an earlier version, In the latest version, I found essentially the same deficiencies that needed to be addressed. Really, from the time 2 years ago that I became aware of the K-1 exemption that was allowing single houses to be torn down without notice to anybody. We can't solve all of the problems associated with demolition permitting in the 2 months since the December hearing, but I conclude that even the most basic level, the language that is proposed is clearly weakening the issues that are needing to be addressed. And they are weakening them in favor of development interests, despite the positive efforts of UNR that our neighborhood has supported. Consider the issue of time. The DRAC managed, and perhaps they are not the appropriate group to be writing the code, the DRAC managed rewrite requires the appellant not only to decide an appeal and decide to appeal and to appeal the demolition permit within 35 days of the application date, but to have both a specific solution and feasible plan for preserving the property to accompany the appeal, and the request for a registered letter simply adds another gratuitous impediment. The notice and wake-up cycle alone can easily take 2 weeks. Developing a plan could easily require several weeks of volunteer effort. Even for our neighborhood, where we have regular land use meetings and were able to organize a special board meeting in early summer to discuss and approve the appeal for cause, we did not have a plan at that point, and we would not have been able to generate a plan. Developing a plan takes time and negotiation. It's all but impossible without providing the recognized organization some kind of wedge. The intent of the 120-day stay in the existing code provides time to develop a plan. In two recent examples, the 120-day stay or threat thereof was the only hammer to get the developer to the table to discuss the issues. And it wasn't necessarily to ultimately save the property, but we needed to have that hammer to get the developer to the table. That's not to say that all developers are evil and don't take responsibility, but there are plenty of them out there who really don't want to be bothered discussing the issues with the neighborhood.
Right, I want to get you to wrap up soon.
Yep. With the proposed language, the developer can wait for the code hearings officer to decide the credible plan is in place, and if so, begin to respond. Compressing the delay from 120 to 60 only undercuts the urgency to talk. A BDS plan review can take 30 to 60 days and more with appeals and adjustment. A developer has little or nothing to gain from engaging in any kind of negotiation. I see the unintended consequences of making it easier to demolish viable, affordable housing without neighborhood opposition. I'm just close to finishing here. The lack of vision or clarity in the new version, the confusing redefinition of demolition, the language to remove the one tool that advantages the neighborhood associations, and not least the lack of public process in developing this suggests that this proposal is not ready for a vote. The only vote that is essential short term is the removal of the K-1 exemption clause from the existing code. It's a common courtesy to notify neighbors of the impending demolition, and it's that simple until we get a broader solution. Thank you.
Thank you. You know the K-1 exemption is deleted in the draft.
Right. Just take the existing code, strike K-1, and we've got a better solution than we have in this proposal.
Thank you. Welcome.
Good afternoon. My name is Gary Clifford. I'm presenting this on behalf of Barbara Kerr. 43 and counting neighborhoods have formally supported the UNR reform resolution. In attending those neighborhood meetings, there was no question they wanted deconstruction if a home had to be removed and could not be moved. The question is, why would you require deconstruction for all demolitions? That's easy. The list of benefits is long. The real question is, why wouldn't you require deconstruction? The answer is time. Mechanical demolition can happen in a day. Deconstruction can take a few days to several weeks. Time is money. Requiring deconstruction is thought to be asking the developer to increase expenses that don't increase profits. Free enterprise is being free to produce, buy, and sell a product without restriction. But free enterprise is not free. As a business person, I'm responsible for paying the cost of my production. Free enterprise is not being restricted by the public good, but it is also not being financially supported by the public. Mechanical demolition puts hazardous waste into the air, the soil, and the surrounding neighbor's property. The costs of cleaning this up are beyond calculation. Mechanical demolition puts waste in our landfills, which are subsidized by the public. Wood waste releases methane into the atmosphere over time. Would you put that genie back in the bottle? Mechanical demolition removes existing building materials from our supply, necessitating all the costs to the environment of producing new ones. True free enterprise would mean the developer would pay these expenses as simply the cost of doing business. Do we really think these costs would be less than the price of deconstruction? A smart business person would work deconstruction into their schedule while working on the many tasks of readying a construction project to be built. There are developers who have found the benefits and are ahead of the curve, but by far the majority have not. Deconstruction needs to be required, or we need to stop subsidizing mechanical demolition. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all. Thanks very much.
Was there a Jerry Federico? Okay. Then we'll go with Orlando Simpson, Malachi Milbourne, David Heslam. Got one over there. Chad Wykus, John Taylor, Steve Mezzanetti. Look, we've got.
Okay. Got three. Welcome.
Thank you, Mayor Hales and council members. My name is David Heslam. I'm executive director of Earth Advantage, a 501c3 nonprofit based here in Portland, Oregon. And I'm a 21-year Portland resident living in the Overlook neighborhood. I apologize, Mayor Hales, for not, I'm not going to speak directly about the delay policy. I'm going to shine a bright light on the need for deconstruction. And since I'm not following your rules, I'll be very short.
Okay.
Just I just really appreciate you noting that. Nobody else has, so you, well, not nobody.
Well, at the end of the day, maybe there's
no. It's this is a very important discussion that needs to happen, and it will inform the next process that Mayor Hales will be setting up with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. That I appreciate your acknowledgement that you're not planning to speak to the amendment.
Fair enough. So we've been training, setting metrics for performance of buildings, setting standards for, and training professionals for 10 years, including on deconstruction practices for the last 3 years across the state of Oregon. And there are so many benefits associated with it that maybe haven't been totally clearly articulated. One is around, it's a great entry point to the residential construction industry to come in as a deconstruction specialist. And the construction industry is in need of more people coming in at the low end of the construction industry and finding a career ladder to move up. If we were to be able to promote a large percentage of the current demolitions into deconstruction, we would see a great increase in that labor force who could move their way up into better paying jobs as they gained experience in the construction industry. Additionally, I will supply a copy of the DEQ report that was mentioned earlier. It's a life cycle approach to prioritizing methods of preventing waste. We helped DEQ and with the State Homebuilder Association produce that report 5 years ago. It's still very pertinent. It discusses about 14 different criteria of what the benefits are from waste reduction. Deconstruction is specific versus demolition is specifically discussed. And the health benefits that people have discussed are quantified in here, as well as ecosystem benefits and carbon benefits. As mentioned before, you know, if we could divert about 150 houses a year towards deconstruction, that's the same as the carbon sequestered by all of Forest Park's trees. Additionally, just one house would be the same as if you could get five Portlanders to turn their 5-mile each-way commute each day into a bike commute for 7 years.
Hmm. That's great.
For every one house. Thank you.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Hi, my name is Malachi Milbourne, and the spirit of the forest is calling me to be here today. My company name is Against the Grain PDX. I'm a furniture maker, woodworker, professional denailer. I've been doing this full-time for 6 years now, and I've saved a lot of wood from historical houses pre-1930s. It kind of started off with a trend. I was into barn wood and that type of aesthetic. It's a huge trend right now. And then it is evolved into wood with integrity, old-growth wood, which is really encapsulated best in these old houses. I can't believe how much I've seen with my own eyes just get needlessly thrown away. And my whole philosophy and business model is to give this wood a higher purpose. I'm making heirloom furniture that's actually being put into people's homes, and they should have it for 100 years or more, depending. I have a lot of good stories, but I'll just only share a couple with you. Someone brought up the Markham House recently. And now that was being saved, and so nobody was really thinking of it as a deconstruction because they're going to restore it. Well, I've actually been on the property, and that house is in terrible shape. There's really no reason to save that house except for somebody doesn't want, you know, an eyesore or something in the new construction. Well, it looks like a Spanish hacienda house that doesn't fit in the landscape anyway, in my opinion. So at any rate, all this wood is getting thrown away into a huge container. And I stopped by and I was like, well, what are you guys doing with this stuff? And then I just watched it go away to a landfill. They still had plenty of material there left. And so I was like, guys, I can save you whatever it costs for you to put that in the landfill, which ended up being over $300 per container. I saved thousands of board feet from that house, and it would have needlessly been thrown away. Now people think they're not seeing the point. The point of preserving the wood from that house was the biggest issue, and everyone wanted to see that house be preserved, but the whole skeleton's been removed with new wood. So to me, that doesn't make any sense at all. And so I just want to let you know, like, it's not that hard to find people like me. The Yon Building, 7th and Alder, I removed a flagpole from it in 2012. You can see the documentation on YouTube. Yon flagpole, check it out, because it's a 30-foot flagpole that I had salvaged, and they wanted it to go to a good home. Well, I made a table, and the table went back in the building. It's going to be there for who knows how long.
That's great.
If they wouldn't have done that, it would have just been like whatever, like everything else. I just want you guys to really think that we could be the leaders in preserving the natural resources that we have. Japan's way ahead of us. They've been saving our natural resources and saving old growth material because they know it's going to be extinct at some point. It will run out. We need to be the forefront. We need to save. There needs to be a deconstruction happening to any house pre-1930s, at least a consultation to see what the value in the material is. And I consider that under an urban lumber bracket. I would also consider that the urban lumber also includes mature trees in the property. So if a property developer needs to remove a tree, they also need to facilitate that in the program. I think it should be in the same bracket of urban lumber because there's billions of board feet that are eventually going to get removed from this city. And if we don't, you know, harvest that a little bit and get it to the right places, we're shooting ourselves in the foot. And we did this in the 1920s, and the Industrial Revolution killed all our trees. And so I'm here for the forest and speaking on their behalf. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Mayor House Commissioners, I'm Steve Messinetti with Habitat for Humanity, and I'll stay mostly on topic. I think hasn't been said enough that this issue of demos is not just an issue related to high-end builders, but as a nonprofit developer, it also affects us who and other even for-profit developers who are trying to build homes that are affordable to low- and middle-income families in our city. And we support the proposal that includes, I believe, reasonable delays for reasonable reasons. But I also believe that demos are another variable leading to the lack of affordable housing product in our city, which is, I think, approaching crisis level. I encourage you to explore ways to increase incentives for nonprofit and for-profit developers to build homes that are affordable to low and middle income families to buy. The tax abatements and the SDCs are set there and are great, but they're no longer enough, especially in neighborhoods that have rising land values. So more needs to be looked at to create these incentives to create product affordable to the families who live and work here. And if we can do so, if we can create these homeownership opportunities, our neighborhoods will maintain the diversity that we've talked about and avoid the further displacement that we are trying to avoid. Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Is there a John Taylor? Okay, we'll go with Brandon Spencer. Paul Sheely.
I don't think you should do this now, but we'll let you do it this time.
And Ken Forcier. Is there Ken Forcier?
Welcome. Afternoon.
Good afternoon. My name is Paul Sheely. I'm here to present a perspective you probably haven't heard much in these hearings. I sold a house to a builder. I'm running to share my experience with you so that you will have heard another perspective on the issue of demolition of houses to rebuild new houses. In 2010, my wife and I bought a house in Southcrop, Birmingham for $400,000. There are houses in our neighborhood that were built in every decade of the last century. Our house was built in 1949. It was kind of a cross between a 40s house and a 50s ranch. It was a pretty big house, but it was a two-bedroom, one-bath on the main floor. We knew the floor was a little undesirable for that reason, but we liked the house. We only had one child, and we had plans to eventually remodel. It was on a nice corner lot with a partial view. The lot was 100 feet wide facing the street. We put $25,000 down on the house. The payment was $27.80 a month. By 2012, my wife and I were in the middle of a divorce. We were facing all the financial and emotional issues that go along with that miserable experience. We had the house for sale for months with zero interest from regular buyers. While it was for sale, we found out that the house had been for sale for 2 years before we bought it. All the realtor had to say was that for this price, that people want a master bath, they want an island kitchen, they want walk-in closets, they don't like the metal siding that went on the house in the 60s, they don't like the 60s remodel of the bathroom. We didn't get one offer. Eventually, we got an offer from a builder who planned to tear the house down, split the lot into 50-foot-wide lots, like all the ones around it, and build two houses on the property. The neighbors found out about it and started showing up at our door demanding we not sell to a builder. They held meetings in front of our house. They confronted me as I came and went. These people had no intention of putting up any of their own money, but if they could have done it, they would have been willing to prevent my wife and I from selling the property while forcing us to keep paying the mortgage as long as they could delay the process. Every 4 weeks, I would send in that $3,000, and they would have held things up as long as they could. They tried to dissuade the buyer. They did whatever they could. And these impediments that are being added in will be used for that purpose. These neighbors would have no problem with us just continuing to make that payment until a buyer that was more to their liking came along. This offer from Everett Owens was the only offer we got. It broke my heart to see that house get torn down. But I pay my bills. I set my payment in every 4 weeks. No one wants urban sprawl. We all want to keep our close-in neighborhoods nice. We like having our property values go up. We want to make efficient use of the infrastructure. This house had 100 feet of street frontage that serviced one bathroom. That's 100 feet of street, gas, electric, street lighting, police, ambulance, all that was serving the purpose of feeding that one bathroom. It was a two-bedroom, one-bath house on a 100 feet wide lot. The fact is, it had more value as a lot than it did as a house. That's why these houses are being torn down. As you do your job, please remember that these lots are private property. Putting restrictions on the ability to sell an unmarketable house just to please the neighbors is, in my opinion, a taking of private property by government. If there is an easement for view or an easement for light, let them enforce it, but there just isn't. The city imposes height restrictions on houses. These are permitted houses. These houses aren't being torn down to build bars, and they're not being torn down to build mini-marts. They're being torn down to build other houses. It's not a change in use. It's private property. I know you're never going to keep anyone happy. Remember, we're talking about real estate rising to its highest and best use. That's what happens when a city is thriving. Take a look at any picture of an old neighborhood in Portland from 100 years ago. It's full of old houses that aren't there anymore.
Appreciate your testimony. Why don't you get you to wrap up?
That's it.
Okay. Thank you. Appreciate your perspective.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Brandon Spencer Hartle. I'm here today representing Restore Oregon, and I'll be as succinct as I can. On July 31st, many of us who are in the room today came to you with three asks. One was to define demolition in the building regulations. Two was to remove the K1 exception to get us a 30-day mandatory delay with an additional 120-day option. And third was to establish a demolition task force. Since that time, I've been working closely with BDS staff and the Development Review Advisory Committee. Since that time, it's also been 6 months for us to get the emergency changes that we asked for in July. And the proposal in front of you doesn't go as far as we had asked. I'm here today to support this as a compromise emergency measure, but to support it with the caveat that we hope that future changes from the council and the establishment of a task force indeed follows up today's discussions and the discussions ahead of us. The compromise that's in front of you will allow us to collect better data, focus energy on zoning and compatibility issues, and explore models for deconstruction policies. These changes to Title 24, while necessary and hopefully the first step, will not by themselves resolve the neighborhood change crisis we're facing today. So I'm here today to ask you to approve this, thinking of it as an emergency compromise and looking forward for a more proactive and inclusive process to address zoning, compatibility, and the larger demolition question of what does this mean for the city and where are we going? Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Okay. Ken Forcier or Fernando Marin? Okay, so the last people I show signed up are Rob Humphrey, Mary Helen Kincaid, and Jeff Fish.
Your chair, you gotta get
the I'm the chair, I get the chair.
They're gonna let you go first?
No, I'm going last.
Oh, all right. I'll be first,
Mr. Mayor, commissioners, thanks for your time. My name's Rob Humphrey. I'm a citizen of Portland. My business is Faster Permits. We're a building permit management and consulting firm serving Portland residents for nearly 24 years. Our clients do include governmental agencies, industrial organizations, commercial businesses, developers, residential builders, architects, engineers, and many other parties whose activities require building permits. We have managed countless thousands of building permit processes in the city of Portland, but the most significant of these are the thousands we've managed for the citizens of Portland. Homeowners, potential home buyers, people whose homes require renovation, or those whose homes have outlived their intended life expectancy and require replacement. I also serve as vice chair of DRAC and have participated in virtually every meeting of the DRAC Demolition Subcommittee. I'd like the council to know and to hear that this committee has been unusual, unprecedented, and in fact groundbreaking in the manner in which the stakeholders on all three sides of the issue, the Portland citizens and neighborhood associations, specifically the UNR was there in force, and there was a moment there where one of the UNR folks was disappointed that DRAC was writing code, but to be more specific, the DRAC Demo Subcommittee that wrote this code had, I think, four members of the development community, one of them being me, which I'm sort of not because I represent both sides, a home builder and two residential remodelers, and the rest were city staff and the neighbors. So that's really who wrote this, okay?
And how many neighbors were there?
Many. I mean, it varied with each meeting, but there were many.
Anybody was welcome to come and participate.
Yeah, it was wide open, and I was impressed with the way the city gave everybody a voice in that. Really, it was very inclusive. Going back to my point, those folks were at the table, and the BDS staff and the residential building community were represented there. With the three that I mentioned. Anyway, I'm impressed by how they've collaborated in such a meaningful way. Imagine what it must have been like to have each of these stakeholder groups, each well represented, as I mentioned, locked in the same room and each with a voice for countless hours over the past several months. Though painstaking and often heated, we held the line. We didn't give up. We stayed the course, even in the face of so much off-topic discussion like, why does the zoning code allow for two homes to be built where one once was in my neighborhood? or what about the process of deconstruction? I'm here just to talk about Agenda 169 today. I'm convinced that all sides have come away with a newfound understanding and respect for each other's position, the likes which I haven't seen previously, doing this for 24 years. Yes, I am saying that I have witnessed citizens and neighborhoods respecting residential builders, even lot splitters, and vice versa. Most importantly, we've come away with a proposal to you, our city council, that has been well vetted by each of these stakeholders, and I'm not saying it's been vetted by each and every citizen of the city, but it certainly has been vetted by those who came to the table for those countless hours and weighed in on every side of the debate. And we're not just talking about neighborhood associations and infill developers here. We're talking about that middle-aged woman who inherited the 800-square-foot home that she grew up in, staying there for 20 years and saving every penny, knowing that her retirement was secure and her ability to one day develop that land. It's the young family who bought the only house they could afford, one beyond its intended life of service, on that perfect piece of land in the perfect neighborhood, hoping one day to build a bigger and healthier home for their expanding family. And it's that family whose life has been rocked by illness. The only means to pay for treatment is to split that lot off their home and sell it or develop it. Make no mistake, all sides have compromised in this matter. Reducing the 120-day extension was a huge give by the neighborhoods. Likewise, eliminating the K1 exception was a huge give by the development community. But where will we end up? We'll end up with a mandatory 35-day notification period on every demolition, by which no citizen should ever again be surprised by a bulldozer tearing down the house next door. We'll also end up with a means by which interested and capable parties are afforded more time to seek alternatives to demolition. And we'll have removed the opportunity for those who sought to abuse the existing system for reasons that were not in seeking alternatives to demolition. In conclusion, I respectfully ask that you vote today to approve DRAC's proposed modifications to the demolition process as written. It would be a great shot in the arm to those former foes who are experiencing for the first time a degree of unity. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for your work on this. Thank you. Mr. Fish.
I don't think it'll be, well, I'll be back up. Jeff Fish, Fish Construction, been builder in 42 years in Portland, infill builder. DRAC member, came off DRAC on January 25th, came off as chair on January 25th, but I'm still on the subcommittee at Mary Helen's request. Pretty hard to follow up what Rob just said. That being said, when I asked him to be part of this committee several months ago, he initially pooh-poohed me and didn't want to do it. And as you can see, here's a guy that sees the issues and understands the issues and did a great job of summarizing things. But I want to move on. I want to address some of the things brought up today. I don't have any specific written remarks. That hazardous material issue is going to be a bear to deal with. We dealt with it at DRAC, got into it. There's a lot of different facets to it. Asbestos is handled by DEQ. Lead base is handled by the Oregon Health Authority. And for lack of a simple way, they don't care about what happens on the property next door. They care about what happens with the worker tearing down the house. Now, if he's in jeopardy, then they pick up the house next door. That was the best way I could explain what we were told by Chris Zimmer. I also talked with some BDS staff, and I don't think Paul knew about this until I mentioned to him a few minutes ago. It's hard to interpret. One of the BDS staff I talked to was in that business prior to going to work for the city. And he said, you can write an asbestos report, and you can tweak it such that it doesn't look too bad, but get away with stuff. So in some respects, it puts the BDS staff in a bad light if they accept a report that somebody later is kind of going around. So I'm not telling you to go there. I'm just going to say it's a landmine to walk through. So the other thing about that is I've tried to find out on – there were two houses on 16th just – north of Holgate that were torn down, supposedly had asbestos floating around. I haven't been able to find out from DEQ whether or not those houses did have the problem. I think there's a lot more hysteria than there is actually in problems. We tore our house down 2 years ago behind the Martin Luther King Parr Lumber Company. We had an asbestos report and we had asbestos removal. I walked in that house. And it had one of the items it had a popcorn ceiling. I walked in that house and I see all the sheetrock dust all over. And I walked right back out the door and called both the persons that wrote the report and the person that did the removal to make sure they got